Most of you have already felt the pains in your communities of, we can't use the word recession, but we certainly know what is happening to our people back home.
Hi, and welcome to NPR's Planet Money. Today is Wednesday, October 29th. It's about 4:14 p.m. here in New York City. I'm Laura Conaway. Adam Davidson is out in the field reporting again. We are working on a major, major project. It's very cool. I can't wait to tell you all about it when it's ready. Next week, I think. Later on in the show today, we're going to take on a very tough listener question. For now, today's news. That was New York Congressman Charles Rangel you just heard. He was talking finance and economics with governors on Capitol Hill today. We're hearing that the federal government is working on a plan to save homeowners from foreclosure. We don't have many hard details yet. The idea, maybe, is to rework mortgages so that people pay according to their incomes. This reminds me of some of my student loans, actually. And in the news we know, the Federal Reserve lopped half a point off the benchmark interest rate today. That is the second cut in 3 weeks. The rate is now down to 1%. People have been saying the stock market would react to another announcement like that. So for our Planet Money indicator today, we're going to turn to Vinny Catalano. He's the president of the investment firm Blue Marble Research. Vinny, how's the market?
The market actually is looking more promising. It remains, fairly volatile, but for a number of reasons that I've listed up on my blog today, there are calendar-related items, market-related items, and valuation-related items that say, stocks, I think, can go another 10 to 15% higher from here, which would be kind of cheery news.
How did they close out today?
The S&P was down, but the broad market overall, I believe, was up. The S&P overall ended up being down 10.
10%.
I actually look at that more than I look at, like, the Dow Jones. But there were stocks up for every three that went down.
Vinny, do you mean 10 points or 10%?
10 points.
Percent would be huge.
Yeah. Well, that was yesterday. No, not much of a move today.
So no particular reaction to the cut in interest rates?
No, not at all. No, very limited, because I think what the Fed did was come out with pretty much what everybody thought that they were going to do, which is cut rates about 0.5%, say that the economy is a little bit shaky, that they're concerned about a recession. The one piece of good news that was in there is that they are far less concerned about inflation because of commodity prices being down and because of the economy slowing down. So, bad news sometimes can produce a little bit of good news, and that's what you got with the inflation side of the equation.
Vinny Catalano, thank you.
Thank you.
Take care out there. That was Vinny Catalano of Blue Marble Research. We'll link to his blog on ours at npr.org/money. And we're moving on. Adam noticed today, he sent an email from the field. He said a big deal historian was due into the studio. He was not here to talk to us. He was here to talk to higher, greater luminaries at NPR. The historian's name is John Steele Gordon. He specializes in finance and economics. I asked him about today's cut. What kind of territory are we in when we get to 1%, historically speaking?
Well, it's gone lower. It was down to 0.5% right after September 11th, or in the aftermath of September 11th. But that's getting, you can't make a negative interest rate. And so you're beginning to run out of room to influence the system with interest rate cuts, because, you can't, tell banks to pay folks to take the money.
During the Depression, what were interest rates like?
Well, the Fed actually kept interest rates quite high in the early days of the Depression, and that was one of the great causes of turning an ordinary recession into the Great Depression. The Federal Reserve was basically leaderless after Benjamin Strong died in 1928. He had been the governor of the New York Fed, and the rest of the Federal Reserve system had taken its cue from him, but he died. And at that point, they were fighting inflation, and so they were raising interest rates, and interest rates were about 5% in 1929. After the crash, they should have immediately reduced the interest rates. They should have flooded the street with liquidity. And instead, they kept it high because they basically didn't know what to do.
Could you define liquidity for me?
Liquidity is money. The more easily you can sell something, the more liquid it is. And real estate is notoriously the most illiquid of investments because each piece of real estate is unique, and you have to find a buyer who wants that particular piece of real estate at a price he's willing to pay. Other things are more easily converted into money, and money, of course, is the most easily – you can always buy something with money. And so liquidity is when it's liquidity is hard to come by when people are trying to get into money, when they're trying to sell other assets. In a crash, for instance, what you have is everybody are selling stock at any price in order just to get the money.
So when the Federal Reserve lowers the rate, is it trying to add liquidity to the system?
No. In this case, what they're trying to do is make it easier for people to borrow. And so more likely to do so. I mean, they're trying to lower the cost of borrowing.
Is this tied in any way to the consumer confidence numbers we saw yesterday? I talked to a fellow, Ken Goldstein, who was saying that the numbers, the consumer confidence number, is the lowest it's been in 35 years since they started the survey.
Yes. I mean, they want to do is prevent people from becoming overly cautious. They want to, the moment... there's an old saying on Wall Street that there are only two emotions when it comes to money, greed and fear. And at the moment, people are saying it's a good time to put in a good word for greed.
We had an economist, Simon Johnson of Baseline Scenario, advise a listener yesterday who said he basically stopped spending money. And I have to say, I'm in this camp. And Simon Johnson's advice was, please buy a little something.
Yes. The world is not coming to an end. We're in a serious financial situation, but the governments of the world are beginning to get a handle on it, it would appear. Credit is beginning to unfreeze. I expect that in 6 months or a year, things will have settled down. It's probably going to take longer than that to get back to a new growth cycle. But it's not the end of the world, and we don't have to start planting potatoes in the backyard. Now, we're not trying to encourage irresponsible borrowing. The Fed is trying to encourage responsible borrowing. I mean, if you have a 10-year-old car and it's costing you a lot of money to maintain it, maybe it's time to go out and buy that new car that you've been planning to do. And suddenly with all this financial hullabaloo, you're saying, oh, maybe not. I'll wait another year. And they're saying, no, don't. It's time to go out and buy that car.
So a drop... Is that the kind of move that makes it easier to buy a house but not necessarily easier to buy a flat-screen TV with a credit card?
Yes, it'll help you with the house. It will not help you with the flat-screen TV or the Caribbean vacation put on your credit card because credit card interest rates are way higher than that. And the Fed has very little influence on those interest rates.
And that's what you mean when you say they're trying to encourage responsible borrowing?
Yes.
Can you explain to our audience, please, why it is that when interest rates go down, stocks tend to go up? What's the connection?
Well, as interest rates go down, bonds become less attractive.
Because bonds are loans.
Well, a bond is a loan, yes. When you buy a bond, you're loaning that corporation or that government, treasury bonds, money, and they pay you interest on that money. As the interest rates go down, the people are less willing to buy bonds because they're getting less money in return, and so they're more interested in buying stocks, which have a chance of appreciating as well as paying dividends. I mean, there's some stocks now, of good, solid companies whose dividends are paying 5-6%, whereas Treasury bonds right now are paying around 3.6 and change, if I remember correctly.
If we can't look to the Great Depression for ideas about what's happening now, where else in history could we look to try to understand the state of this economy and how to fix it?
Well, there's the Great Depression is not a very good analogy to the current situation. There are cases as to how we got into this mess. The S&L crisis of the 1980s is a good example, in which the federal government and state governments tried to help savings and loan institutions rather than forcing them to merge or go out of business or become full-service banks. They tried to save what was unsavable, and it ended up being very expensive. That's what we did in this case. We tried to provide loans to people to buy houses who were basically uncreditworthy and couldn't pay back the loan. They had, you know, no down payment loans, and which meant that if the loan would be instantly underwater if housing prices declined. And it gave the borrower no skin in the game. He had no down payment. He had nothing to lose. So he moves into the house, lives there for a year, gets foreclosed upon, and
he walks away.
Big deal. It was a disastrous idea, but, you know, these kind of disastrous ideas are often seen in retrospect more clearly than in foresight.
So are we watching 1987 all over again in the sense that we're having to pick winners and losers here?
You know, banking is a very peculiar business. It's in the money business. And if a shoe factory goes out of business, well, somebody else will manufacture the shoes. But if the banking system collapses, then the entire economy collapses with it. And therefore, I mean, banks, big banks, are quite literally too big to fail, because if they did, then the whole system would crash in ruins along with them. And, you know, everybody would be poor. Now, what they're doing now is they're injecting capital into the banks in order partly to encourage lending, because your amount of capital determines how much money you can lend. And also just to stabilize them. And then in a few years, when they have stabilized, then these banks are being expected to buy back that preferred stock that they have sold to the government. And hopefully the government will make a buck on the process.
A lot of people have been asking about this idea that the government is putting capital into banks in the hopes that the banks will lend. And yet some of the banks aren't necessarily lending that money back out.
At the moment, but it's very recently that they got the money. I mean, you can't get an infusion of $25 billion and lend out $250 billion by, you know, the following Saturday.
It's not a hot dog stand.
It's not a hot dog stand.
Yeah. So you say, hang on a minute, you think they will?
I think they will. They are under tremendous pressure to do so. I mean, the White House yesterday suggested very strongly that they do exactly that.
I think they may be listening now.
I think they're listening.
Thanks to John Steele Gordon for taking a few extra minutes to explain the world to us here on Planet Money. One of the things we like to do on Planet Money is take your questions, and I mean not just take them, but answer them. Even when we, or maybe in this case, just I, am starting from scratch. So here's one from Sean Flynn of Chicago, who said he'd recently read this confusing article.
Yeah, it was about something called a yen carry, where I guess people were borrowing Japanese money on the cheap and then converting it to some other type of currency, and that gave them more money in return. And then, so anyway, there was some type of scheme that I didn't quite understand, but it made people a lot of quick money. And I was hoping I could understand it better. It seemed like the kind of schemes that have been backfiring for people lately.
And what do you think it's called?
A yen carry, as in the money, the yen. And I'm not sure why they mean carry, but carrying, like carrying a backpack or something like that.
The yen carry. I think I've also seen yen carry trade.
Yes.
Which is what I guess the whole thing would be.
Yes, I think they're trading. Yeah, it's kind of like a derivative. Not that I don't know anything about derivatives, but it seems like something where they were concocted a scheme where they carry the yen and trade these things behind.
We need to ask somebody, Sean.
Yes.
we're going to ask somebody.
I need help.
Okay. All right. So, Meg Brown, what is it? Why should we care?
Okay. I'll talk about what it is first. It's a trade where you borrow in yen and invest somewhere else, hoping to make a better return than what you're paying out. The reason it's called a yen carry trade, you borrow in yen. Yen rates have been very low for some time. I'm talking at the moment about 0.5% that you have to pay to borrow money in Japan. And that money has been invested in countries like Australia or New Zealand that have much higher rates, say 8%. So if currency markets weren't involved, you would hope to earn a return of about 7.5% on that over the course of a year. The yen carry trade isn't the only kind of trade out there. There's also carry trades involving, say, borrowing in U.S. dollars and investing in the same currency, but also you could invest in Brazil, for example, where yields are 13, 14%.
Can I back up?
I
need to back up and do this in my own silly layman's terms because I want to make sure I understand. So I'm an American, and let's say I have $1,000 sitting around, and I'm going to do something with that $1,000. And I decide that I'm going to do a yen carry trade. So I take my $1,000, and I go to a money broker. Am I on the right track?
Actually, an individual could certainly do this, but you could do it. What if you did it in U.S. dollars? Because you've already got the money.
I've got the $1,000, but I need to borrow in yen, right? I need to borrow some money from Japan, basically. Somebody in Japan. Is that right?
Right.
Yes, I got part of it right. Okay, so I go to a Japanese bank.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Or you could go to any bank.
Okay, and I say to them, I want to borrow 1,000 Japanese yen.
Do you want to borrow $1,000 worth of yen?
Okay. And they hand them to me in a big sack.
They'll put it in an account, yes.
Okay. So I know something smart to do with those yen, and that is to invest it someplace like Australia.
Right.
Now, how do I actually invest it in Australia? Am I buying stocks? Am I loaning it? Am I buying a bond?
Bonds or some form of interest-bearing account.
Okay, and the reason I'm doing that is because Japanese banks right now are charging very low interest rates on the yen.
Right.
Yes, you can't know how excited I am to get this. Okay, and in Australia, bonds are going for a high rate of return.
Right. This is all hypothetical because the world is just tilted on its axis, but yes.
Okay, so we're going to stand the world up on its axis for just a second. Borrow $1,000 in yen. I got to pay some interest on it. But then I turn around and I buy a bond, which is I make a loan to some government entity in Australia or to an Australian company that's trying to raise money. And I rake in the interest over there. And I use some of that to repay my loan in yen.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that I take to the store and I buy something with it.
Yes, that's a very good theoretical description of it.
So why should people care about yen carry trades?
Because this is one way to make money, but it's a risky. It works in certain environments and not in others. So in an environment where there's a lot of liquidity, and also where there's a lot of the volatility in a currency market is lower, and that means that, for example, in this case, Australian dollars valued against Japanese yen. Say that just stayed at one.
Okay.
That's very low volatility. That's no volatility.
In which case, they're equal.
Right.
Okay.
One for one, they stay that way. For the entire year, you earn that interest.
But what's happening to currencies now?
We do not have a liquid environment, and we do not have a low volatility environment at all.
So your workplace is a mess.
We have an environment where people are worried about risk, where people are pulling back their exposures, where they're cutting positions that might have been making them money, which might have been a carry trade. So that's going on at the same time. So one, it's harder to borrow. Two, there's always been a currency risk, but it's really obvious that there's a currency risk now. And what is that risk? That risk is, and always has been for the carry trade, that one-for-one ratio of Australian dollars to the Japanese yen, that it could move all over the place. And it could move more than the 8% interest that you're earning.
So are currencies moving all over the place?
Yes.
Meg Brown, she's a currency strategist for Brown Brothers Harriman in New York, and she says that it really is possible to understand the currency markets and that she is living proof. So right now, Meg Brown, I'm putting my faith in you. I'm going to keep asking questions until I understand it, because currency is one of the hardest things I've encountered since I started working on this show. It may actually be harder than credit default swaps. Anyway, Brown also told us some things about gold and what's happening with the price of that. We'll be putting that on our blog later this week. She also explained what's happening to the Canadian dollar. We've been getting a lot of letters from listeners about that. For now, that's a podcast. Thanks for hanging around the blog. We love that. We're at npr.org/money. I'm Laura Conaway. Thanks for listening.